scripture this morning is Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. Mark 3, 1 through 6. Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with Herodians against him, how to destroy him.
Good morning. Quick announcement before I forget. In the bulletin we mentioned we're looking for three scholarships for campers for camp next week. They're $100 a piece. I got two out of three this morning, and so I'm looking for one more. And you guys, as always, are very generous. And, of course, if someone beats you to it, you're welcome to just hand us money, too. It doesn't have to be for a camper. Well, donations are also welcome. It just buys that much more cookies and sports equipment, which reminds me, cookies. If you didn't see the announcement in the bulletin, we always need cookies at camp. I don't know if you've ever done the math, but I have. Two cookies per camper, twice a day, 6 days, 53 campers. We go through about 1,000 cookies in the course of a week. So the more the merrier. If you can get those to us by this coming weekend, that would be fantastic. And they love the homemade ones. They don't get to eat any of them. I keep those for myself. But they do love them, and we appreciate when you bring them. We're going to start a new series this morning that's going to last about 6 weeks, take us into the middle of July this summer, and we're calling it The Strong Man, Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. Every gospel has its own little twist on the story of Jesus. Each one tells the basic details, but all of them have a point of emphasis that's a little different from the others. And one of the themes in Mark's gospel is about Jesus as a strong man. This week is kind of an introductory thought to that. The real meat of it comes next week, so if I can just tease you about that. And the topic comes from a phrase found in next week's text. Mark chapter 3, 24 through 27 is what I will be preaching on. Let me just hint at it now. Jesus has been casting out demons and evil spirits, and the Pharisees and the Jewish leadership has falsely accused him, irrationally, of casting out those demons by the power of evil itself. In the name of Beelzebub, he casts out demons. And so Jesus thinks that's a bit absurd, and we'll talk about why next week. But he says this, "If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but is coming to an end. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed, he may plunder his house." Jesus says, you're working under the wrong metaphor here. You have been irrationally assuming that if I can give an order and the demons obey, then I must be one of the demons. He says, you're missing the point. He says, it's more like this. If you go into a strong man's house, and this is kind of a funny metaphor, Jesus is now talking about robbery, okay? As explaining his ministry, Jesus the Bandit would be a fun sermon series. He says, if you're going to go into someone's house and to take all their stuff, he says, you have to start by tying up the strong man. You have to start by disarming the defender of the home, the person who is in control of that household. Then you can spoil the goods. And he's applying that to his work of power in casting out demons. He says, they aren't obeying me because I'm one of them. They are obeying because I am more powerful than their boss. He, Satan, is setting himself out as a strong man. He has said, this is my house and I run things here. But Jesus is demonstrating his strength by showing power over every obstacle that comes in his way. And he does it in such an amazing way that, we're going to preach a sermon series about it. Without any of the typical markers of strength, Jesus is going to show us that he is strong enough to be Lord. The person who's Lord has to be strong, right? Leadership, in human terms, is about strength. If you're not strong enough to issue commands and have them be respected, if you aren't strong enough to direct your armies, if you aren't strong enough, even in our system, you know, where it's not as much militaristic, but if you don't have the political capital to get things done, to get people to do what you want in Congress, then you don't have power. Jesus claims that he is Lord. He's going to stake that claim on his demonstration of power. And the way he's going to do that is by picking a fight with a bad guy. He's going to pick a fight with all the obstacles of this world that seem to us to be infinitely powerful. The elements of our life that seem to have so much power, nobody can possibly stand in opposition to it. One by one, he picks a fight with those powers and influences and overcomes them. He binds the strong man quietly and simply, and in so doing, demonstrates his incredible power. So that's the theme for our series, and today we're going to start in chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, by him giving a demonstration of his power over disease. One of the most common elements of the gospel story in Matthew, Mark, or Luke is that Jesus is a worker of miracles, and he overcomes illnesses. Illnesses that were the sort that no one else could heal. The Bible often points out how this was something the person had since birth, or this is a person that many people had tried to heal and had failed. This is something that no one could do anything about, or no one had ever done anything like this before, or all the kind of disclaimers the Bible gives to the miracles of Jesus, because he's not healing people who have a cold, which would be impressive. I have seasonal allergies. I would be fine with that. But this is always something that could not possibly be done. A power that we don't have power over. He shows his strength by binding the strong man. And we start in Mark chapter 3 and verse 1. Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. Now, I love this as an introduction to the sermon series because it is such a perfect analogy to kind of what I'm trying to say. Here we are in the synagogue. What's the synagogue? It is, this is an oversimplification, so don't go look it up and find out I'm wrong, but in an oversimplified sense, it is the Jewish first century equivalent of a church building, church meeting place. It's not exactly that. But in basic terms, it's where they might get together and read the scriptures and say their prayers. It's not the temple, but this is, in a sense, a house of God. And yet there in the house of God was something that was out of place. There was a man with a withered hand. He had a hand, but it wasn't in working order. It was deformed in some way. And the people would go about their business and say their prayers and sing their songs. How often do you suppose they commented on the man with the withered hand who was there week after week? At some point, you kind of stop noticing. And you stop pointing it out because there's not a lot you can do about it. The ruler of that synagogue, whoever was in charge of organizing thing, couldn't snap his fingers and suddenly the man's hand was whole. It wasn't possible. And so you just kind of start moving on and ignoring it. In a sense, it was a reminder of how powerless the people there really were. That they might have power and influence, but they couldn't do anything about that. And if you can't do anything about it, what do? You learn to ignore it, and you learn to just walk by it and not notice it. This is what we do. And throughout the New Testament, there are constantly people in these stories that other people just walk by. Not because they don't care, but because there's nothing they can do about it. This is what we do. This is the world that we live in. It's a place that, in principle, belongs to God. We say that. We sing a song. This is my Father's world. I rest me in the thought. Right? In principle, it is God's world. But from time to time, if we would open our eyes, all the time, we see things that are out of place that make it look as if he's not in charge. A withered hand, a terrible crime, an act of evil, wars and rumors of wars, corruption, all the things that we look at and say, that's not the way it's supposed to be. All of those are examples of Satan, the strong man who claims this is his house, asserting himself, this is mine, this is my domain, and he has taken and twisted this world in the way that it is. What Jesus does is he enters that world and he notices. We don't notice because we've trained ourselves not to look, because we don't want to contemplate the reality that there are things that are very bad in this world. Jesus notices and sets about doing something about it. I think the withered hand is a perfect metaphor for sin in human life and culture. So if you may be a little bit familiar with church history, but let me just kind of give the quick 10-cent tour. For the last several hundred years, there's been like this great debate between the Calvinists and the more humanist sort of Protestants. And they have this great argument. One group says, you have no free will. God is completely in control. And that's the way it is. And everything you do because he does it. And a lot of folks have noticed, well, if that's true, does that mean God's responsible for all the bad things I do? Is God the author of sin and evil? Well, that's a problem. But the other group are kind of the humanists who say, well, God's kind of in control, but at a distance. And what really is going on is you have free will. And they're very optimistic about humanity. And they say, you have free will, you just need to think harder and act harder and do better, and you'll be fine. And yet we read the Bible and we notice that's not exactly the way it works either. And so along comes a fellow Dutch remonstrant by the name of Jacobus Arminius, who says, well, the truth is there, but neither of you are right. You got free will, but it's broke. You got free will, but it's damaged. The Bible talks about sin as scarring the conscience, twisting the mind, corrupting the desires. In essence, your free will is like a man with a withered hand. It's there. All the parts are there. But because of what sin has done, it's not capable of doing what it should be doing. It's not formed correctly. You have it, it's malformed. It's distorted. When you look at this man's withered hand, what would you see? You'd recognize it as a hand. You wouldn't say that man doesn't have any hands. Yeah, he does. And probably if he had had it his entire life, he had learned to do something with it. We knew, Selena and I knew a young girl some years ago who was born without fingers. The hand, right up to the palm, there were little bumps of skin, but in utero, in the womb, the actual skeleton of the bones had never formed, and the muscles and so forth, and so she had just kind of a palm, which she delightfully called her nubbin. Was that what she called it? And her nubbin, she could do anything. I mean, she was, we saw her play soccer, she could do whatever she wanted. She got to be pretty useful with it, but she didn't write with that hand. She didn't take a pencil up with that hand, because she couldn't. It's not possible. This man with a withered hand is further along than she was, in a sense, that he has all the parts there, but it doesn't work. And I'm sure he had learned how to, you know, put his clothes on and do other things. And yet this was a man who's standing at the gates of the synagogue needing help, needing a handout, because he can't go get a job. There's 10 guys in a line for day laborers. One of them has a withered hand. Which one do you hire? Well, you don't hire him. He might be able to get along, but he can't keep up with a man with two hands, healthy and whole. And so he has all the right parts, but he's incapable of providing for his family because it's been malformed. And folks, this is what sin has done to the human heart and to the human will. It's all there. You are at this very hour made in the image of God. It's all there. All the parts are there. But sin distorts it. Sin corrupts it. Sin undermines it. And we just learn to get used to it. We learn to get used to thinking wrong. We do it all the time. We learn to get used to desires pointed in the wrong direction. We do it all the time. And so we go through life with a withered soul. And we say, but God's really in charge. And Satan says, sure he is. Satan seems to be the strong man, but Jesus enters the synagogue and wants to show that that is not the case. A withered hand in the synagogue is a perfect illustration of sin's hold on us. But one thing Mark does is to point out that the truer sign of Satan's rule is in the hearts of those who watched. In verse 2 it says, and they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath so they might accuse him. This is a subtle thing in Mark's gospel. Don't miss it. There's somebody sick in this passage, deeply sick. But in Mark's mind, it's not really the man with the withered hand. The sickest people in the room are the people whose hands work just fine, who are sitting back day after day, noticing a person in need, can't do anything to help him. Jesus is going to act, and they would rather find something wrong with what Jesus is doing than encourage something good. The deeper and truer sign of the fact that Satan is at work in this household is in the hearts of the people standing back to watch. And you'll see this throughout Mark's gospel, and especially in this story. Jesus is always more angry with the people with sin in their hearts than diseases in their skin. He sees the twisted nature of this world and the sicknesses we face as a sad symptom of a world gone wrong. But that's not the problem. The problem is disbelief. The problem is fearfulness. The problem is evil and sin that lurks in the heart of man. So here we are. That's the stage. We're in a synagogue, and we have one man with an obvious distortion and some with a more subtle one. All of them in need of a demonstration of God's power. And so Jesus begins to act in verses 3 through 4 and asserts the true power that he has. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. Don't miss the details in this passage. It is just perfectly written. It is a masterpiece of storytelling in its little tiny details. Okay, first of all, Jesus looks over and says, "Come here." What word is missing from that? Mothers know, please, right? This isn't a request. This isn't, "Hey, could I see you for a moment? Could I have a moment of your time?" Jesus enters the room. Have you ever met somebody who, when they enter the room, whatever room they're in, just seem like they're in charge? It's a strange quality that some people have. And Jesus has that kind of quiet dignity, especially in Mark's gospel. Whenever he enters a room, he just says things and people respond. He just exudes power, but quietly. He's not flailing around. He's not flexing his muscles. He's not showing off. He just enters the room, and you know, this is the guy. This is the one we need to pay attention to. This is power. And so he says to the man, "Come here." And he issues a very direct command. Now, watch the pronouns, because this is great. He says to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And then he says to them. This is Jesus picking a fight now, okay, in case you're not sure. This is Jesus causing a ruckus. He says to the man, "Come." If Jesus just wants to show an act of compassion, which would be perfectly good all on its own, acts of compassion for acts of compassion's sake are great. You don't need another reason. But on this occasion, Jesus happens to have one. He is doing an act of compassion. He says, "Come here, we're going to do something. But first, a question for you." If you read back in the previous chapter, Mark chapter 2 ended with an argument with these same people about whether or not it was okay to heal someone on the Sabbath. They thought they were done with that. Jesus is not. He's going to come back to it. This time, in Mark 2, they brought it to him. His disciples had been plucking grains off the wheat, and they said, "Well, let's work on the Sabbath, you know. That's silly." And so they picked a fight with him. Well, they walked away, and they didn't want to do that anymore. They're licking their wounds, and Jesus says, "Oh, no, we're not done. You asked about the grains on the head of the wheat. I want to ask you a deeper question. Let me ask, and then notice this question. I think," this is Ben's opinion, "deep down inside Jesus is a little bit of a troublemaker." Okay? Listen to the way he phrases this question. "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To save life or to kill?" That is a brutally unfair question when you really think about it. It's a trick question that he asked on purpose. Okay? It's what's sometimes called a complex question, where there is an assumption in the question that you can't possibly answer. Have you stopped beating your wife, or are you still beating her? Yes or no? Which one is it? Well, there's not a right answer to that question, right? Because both answers assume that I must have been beating my wife, right? There isn't a third option. I didn't give it to you. Is it this or that? Pick. Have you stopped beating your wife yet? Jesus says, on the Sabbath, is it better to do good or to do evil? Pick. Well, of course, their answer was, I'm not supposed to do anything. They didn't even want you plucking the grain off the top of the wheat. They had picked fights over all kinds of nonsense. Jesus says, we all know we're doing something. You can't go 24 hours and not do something. You're going to do something on the Sabbath. So which is it going to be? Are you going to do something good, or are you going to do something bad? Are you going to heal, or are you going to harm? Pick. They wanted to ask, is it right to act on the Sabbath? Jesus says, wrong question. The question should be, what kind of actions should you do on the Sabbath? To heal or to harm? And he looks at them and does what every great teacher knows how to do. This is a hard thing. Teachers, by the way, if you're a Bible class teacher or school teacher or whatever, this is the hardest thing, the greatest tool in your arsenal, and the hardest thing to do is to stare awkwardly at people while they don't talk. It's extremely difficult. Like 5 seconds feels like an hour when someone's quiet. And what you do when you teach a class is there's a tendency to ask the question. And when no one immediately responds, you get nervous and you start saying, well, do you think? And you start supplying answers. But if you really want people to talk, you just stare awkwardly at them. And eventually they say, he's going to keep staring, isn't he? And so he asks his question and he just stops. And the text at the end of verse 4 says, but they were silent. How long did that silence drag on? Man, I would have liked to have been there with a stopwatch. I would love to know. How long did it take till the sweat starts coming down their brow? Is he going to say anything? Is he going to move on? Is he going to let us off the hook? Because they have no answer to that. He's in their house. This is their synagogue. But he's binding the strong man, including them. They have no power here. They don't have answers to his basic and simple questions, good or evil. That's actually, I said it was an unfair question, but when you think about it, it's not a hard one. Good or evil, which one? Pick. I bet you I could get some pretty good first graders to answer that one for me, but here are the rulers of the synagogue saying nothing, because they know they were put into a corner. All the while, Jesus is holding a withered man's hand, as if to say, what do you think is going to happen next? Boy, are they worried about that. And so he issues a command, he picks a fight, and those who have just been merely posturing strength, trying to catch Jesus in some kind of accusation, standing back and waiting for something to accuse him of, get put on the spot. You ever notice how brave people are in corners when nobody's listening? How brave people are behind closed doors? But then Jesus says, what about it? Give me an answer. Suddenly, these talkers have nothing to say. And so Jesus finally lets them off the hook in verse 5. And he looked around at them in anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. And I love, first of all, that Jesus' anger, as I mentioned a moment ago, is directed at the disease and not toward the symptom. He has pity towards the man with a withered hand. But he says, that's not really what's wrong with this world. What's wrong with this world is not merely that this man was born with some defect. It is the hardness of heart you have allowed to creep inside of you and live there. The hardness of heart and disbelief that lives alive and well even in the synagogue where the scriptures were read. He says, that's what makes me angry. And that's what makes me sad. That this could go on in a place of prayer. Look around your room, folks. This is where we are. He's looking at us. And he's saying, before you start yelling at heaven and saying, God, why don't you cure disease? And God, why don't you make everybody better? Look around and look at all the sin sickness we allow into our own hearts. We don't have our own house in order. Boy, when something's not right, we're the first to tell God about it. We let all kinds of things into our heart, and we don't like it when he calls us on that. Jesus looked around the room, and he is angry. Angry at what they have allowed to thrive in their hearts. They have become the house of Satan. They have become the place where Satan's influence reigns. They have allowed him to be Lord in a place where God should be Lord, because he rules through doubt, through fear, and through disbelief, and he is angry. So he turns back now to the man with the withered hand and demonstrates his strength. And this is how Mark verse 5 ends. He said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. Anybody disappointed by that, by the way? I wanted something exciting to happen. Jesus is in a towering rage. He's coming to the synagogue. He's picked his fight. What should happen next? The light should dim. Smoke should come out around his feet. He should grow 10 feet tall and issue some kind of incredible command. He should pull out his magic wand. Or at least like maybe one of the preachers on TV, he should take his coat off and like hit somebody or something. There should be something really exciting happens. That's not the nature of Jesus' strength, is it? In so many, I would say nearly all, if not all, of the gospel stories of Jesus' healing, there's one word that describes them: effortless. This is not something he has to summon up his strength to accomplish. He doesn't look winded when it's over. In fact, the most disappointing part of the Gospels is that we never get that thrilling climax where the light show starts and the lightning strikes and something happens. Instead, he just says, let me see your hand, and it's done. It's a blink and you miss it miracle. And nearly all of Jesus' miracles are. Look through the Gospel sometime and look for the smoke and the light show and see where you find them. And you can't. Things just happen effortlessly. 5,000 people out there. I've got some loaves and fishes. What does Jesus say? Well, feed them. And the text doesn't explain it. It just says, we went out and they fed them. We had some left over. It just happened. He says to the man, let me see your hand. And it was better. Can you imagine all the people? The same people staring in disbelief, trying to catch him in a sin, now blinking. What, did that just happen? Because it's almost like it was out without a buildup. You were waiting for something exciting. We love the buildup, right? We love it when you get to work up towards it. This is what sports, American sports, are all about, the buildup, right? We like to slow down and enjoy the moment. Runner on third base, guys at the plate, here's his batting average, here's the pitcher's rating against that batter, here's where we're at in the season, and then we love color commentary. The guys can tell us what's going on. It's why Americans don't really like hockey. Because hockey happens too fast. You're watching, and boom, you score, and you didn't see it. It was so fast, they have to replay it in slow motion. Because it's hard to, like, get excited about it because it happens so fast. We love the buildup for that climactic moment when something happens. And Jesus, instead, just effortlessly says, and now it's healed. And that is all. He doesn't even say, "Is now it's healed." There aren't any even magic words. We don't even get an incantation we can practice at home. Let me see your hand. And it's over. This is the incredible strength of Jesus. And before we're done, this story could be over now, but watch. Mark wants to make one more point to show you Jesus' true strength on display by showing you its opposite. Look at verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Do you see Jesus' power on display in that verse? Watch it carefully. Do they immediately shout him down and say, how dare you heal a man on the Sabbath day? You're under arrest. They don't do that. They have lots of words and lots of accusations. They're just going to say them somewhere else where he can't see them. They're very brave behind closed doors. They're very powerful when nobody's looking. They don't want to say anything else to Jesus. He has completely embarrassed them with his effortless power over disease. And so we're going to go have a private meeting, and we'll talk about him. And we'll all feel better when we leave there because we know we're really in charge. But they're not. This scene, to give you a clue to the book of Mark, plays itself out over and over throughout Mark. And it ends at the death of Christ when Jesus finally calls them on it. Let me just skip ahead. This is a freebie. This is from Mark chapter 14. They come to arrest Jesus in the dead of the night in the Garden of Gethsemane. It says, "And immediately when he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs, and the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, they'd come out of their back room." How exciting. "Now the betrayer had given him a sign saying, 'The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard.'" Okay, they're going to arrest him. They've got a whole mob there to arrest a man who, as far as we know, had never lifted a weapon in his life. "And when he came, he went to him at once and said, 'Rabbi,' and he kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew a sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them," this is the line, "'Have you come out against me as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled.'" He says, "It's funny how brave you got in the dead of night with a mob. Yesterday I was in the temple and nobody arrested me. How odd." What is he pointing out? They have the pretense of power. He has the real thing. And so with a mob in the dead of night, they'll try to lay hands on him. They'll seize him and arrest him and shut him up for good. Because they can't stand to hear him speak. Because every time he speaks, he calls attention to the fact that he has real power. That he has the right to be called Lord. And them, they have nothing. Their Lord has nothing. He and he alone has the right to rule. The strong man is the one standing at the end of the scene. Those cowering are those without power at all. So what's the point for us to take home today? What's the application, if there is one? I think stories like this are supposed to make you ask this question: what could a man with such effortless power over disease do in my life? We get ourselves into messes. We ruin our marriages. We ruin our home. We fill our lives with all kind of sin and evil, and it seems like Satan has a death grip on us, and there's nothing that can be done, and we start to despair. And in pessimism, we say, you know, it's the way it is, it's who I am, it's who I've always been, it's who I'm going to be, there's nothing I can do. And then along comes this man who says, "Let me see your hand." And effortlessly, he fixes things that can't be fixed, and he does it all the time. The man who has more power over disease has power even over the sin in your life. He has power to overcome and to triumph, to restore. Just as illness had distorted the man's hand, he can put right the will that lives within you to begin to make it possible for you to follow him, being conformed, as the passage says, to the image of his dear Son. He makes us human again. He makes us what God made us to be, and he does so effortlessly. Because he's the actual strong man. If you are looking for a source of strength, and we all are, if you're looking for someone who can take hold of your life and make it what it ought to be, find Jesus of Nazareth as that man and let him make you whole again. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If there's anything we can do to help you with that, won't you come?